The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie. Chapter 17. A Midnight Adventure. The inquest took place on the following morning. It was extraordinarily unlike the inquests as pictured in sensational fiction. It satisfied even George Lomax in its rigid suppression of all interesting details. Superintendent Battle and the coroner, working together with the support of the chief constable, had reduced the proceedings to the lowest level of boredom. Immediately after the inquest, Anthony took an unostentatious departure. His departure was the one bright spot in the day for Bill Eversley. George Lomax, obsessed with the fear that something damaging to his department might leak out, had been exceedingly trying. Miss Oscar and Bill had been in constant attendance. Everything useful and interesting had been done by Miss Oscar. Bill's part had been to run to and fro with countless messages, to decode telegrams, and to listen by the hour to George's repeating himself. It was a completely exhausted young man who retired to bed on Saturday night. He had had practically no chance to talk to Virginia all day, owing to George's exactions, and he felt injured and ill-used. Thank goodness, that colonial fellow had taken himself off. He had monopolized far too much of Virginia's society anyway. And of course, if George Lomax went on making an ass of himself like this, his mind seething with resentment, Bill fell asleep. And in dreams, some consolation. For he dreamt of Virginia. It was an heroic dream, a dream of burning timbers, in which he played the part of the gallant rescuer. He brought down Virginia from the topmost story in his arms. She was unconscious. He laid her on the grass. Then he went off to find a packet of sandwiches. It was most important that he should find that packet of sandwiches. George had it, but instead of giving it up to Bill, he began to dictate telegrams. They were now in the vestry of a church, and any minute Virginia might arrive to be married to him. Horror! He was wearing pajamas. He must get home at once and find his proper clothes. He rushed out to the car. The car would not start. No petrol in the tank. He was getting desperate. And then a big general bus drew up, and Virginia got out of it on the arm of the bald-headed baron. She was deliciously cool and exquisitely dressed in gray. She came over to him and shook him by the shoulders, playfully. "Bill," she said. "Oh, Bill." She shook him harder. "Bill," she said. "Wake up. Do wake up." Very dazed, Bill woke up. He was in his bedroom at Chimneys. But part of the dream was with him still. Virginia was leaning over him, and was repeating the same words with variations. "Wake up, Bill. Oh, do wake up. Bill." "Hello," said Bill, sitting up in bed. "What's the matter?" Virginia gave a sigh of relief. "Thank goodness. I thought you'd never wake up. I've been shaking you and shaking you. Are you properly awake now?" "I think so," said Bill, doubtfully. "You great lump," said Virginia. "The trouble I've had. My arms are aching." "These insults are uncalled for," said Bill with dignity. "Let me say, Virginia, that I consider your conduct most unbecoming, not at all that of a pure young widow." "Don't be an idiot, Bill. Things are happening." "What kind of things?" "Queer things. In the council chamber. I thought I heard a door bang somewhere, and I came down to see. And then I saw a light in the council chamber. I crept along the passage and peeped through the crack of the door. I couldn't see much, but what I could see was so extraordinary that I felt I must see more. And then, all of a sudden, I felt that I should like a nice big strong man with me. And you were the nicest and biggest and strongest man I could think of. So I came in and tried to wake you up quietly. But I've been ages doing it." I see, said Bill. And what do you want me to do now? Get up and tackle the burglars? Virginia wrinkled her brows. I'm not sure that they are burglars, Bill. It's very queer. But don't let's waste time talking. Get up. Bill slipped obediently out of bed. Wait while I don a pair of boots, the big ones, with nails in them. However big and strong I am, I'm not going to tackle hardened criminals with bare feet. I like your pajamas, Bill, said Virginia dreamily. Brightness, without vulgarity. While we're on the subject, remarked Bill, reaching for his second boot, I like that thingamabob of yours. It's a pretty shade of green. What do you call it? It's not just a dressing gown, is it? It's a negligee, said Virginia. I'm glad you've led such a pure life, Bill. I haven't, said Bill indignantly. You've just betrayed the fact. You're very nice, Bill, and I like you. I dare say that tomorrow morning, say about 10 o'clock, a good safe hour for not unduly exciting the emotions, I might even kiss you. I always think these things are best carried out on the spur of the moment, suggested Bill. We've other fish to fry, said Virginia. If you don't want to put on a gas mask and a shirt of chainmail, shall we start? I'm ready, said Bill. He wriggled into a lurid silk dressing gown and picked up a poker. The orthodox weapon, he observed. Come on, said Virginia, and don't make a noise. They crept out of the room and along the corridor, and then down the wide double staircase. Virginia frowned as they reached the bottom of it. These boots of yours aren't exactly domes of silence, are they, Bill? Nails will be nails, said Bill. I'm doing my best. You'll have to take them off, said Virginia firmly. Bill groaned. You can carry them in your hand. I want to see if you can make out what's going on in the council chamber. Bill, it's awfully mysterious. Why should burglars take a man in armor to pieces? Well, I suppose they can't take him away whole very well. They'd disarticulate him and pack him neatly. Virginia shook her head, dissatisfied. What should they want to steal a moldy old suit of armor for? Why, chimneys is full of treasures that are much easier to take away. Bill shook his head. How many of them are there? He asked, taking a firmer grip on his poker. I couldn't see properly. You know what a keyhole is, and they only had a flashlight. I expect they've gone by now, said Bill hopefully. He sat on the bottom stair and drew off his boots. Then, holding them in his hand, he crept along the passage that led to the council chamber, Virginia close behind him. They halted outside the massive oak door. All was silent within, but suddenly Virginia pressed his arm and he nodded. A bright light had shone for a minute through the keyhole. Bill went down on his knees and applied his eye to the orifice. What he saw was confusing in the extreme. The scene of the drama that was being enacted inside was evidently just to the left, out of his line of vision. A subdued chink every now and then seemed to point to the fact that the invaders were still dealing with the figure in armor. There were two of these, Bill remembered. They stood together by the wall, just under the Holbein portrait. The light of the electric torch was evidently being directed upon the operations in progress. It left the rest of the room nearly in darkness. Once a figure flitted across Bill's line of vision, but there was not sufficient light to distinguish anything about it. It might have been that of a man or a woman. In a minute or two, it flitted back again, and then the subdued chinking sounded again. Presently there came a new sound, a faint tap-tap, as of knuckles on wood. Bill sat back on his heels suddenly. What is it? Whispered Virginia. Nothing. It's no good going on like this. We can't see anything, and we can't guess what they're up to. I must go in and tackle them. He drew on his boots and stood up. Now, Virginia, listen to me. We'll open the door as softly as possible. You know where the switch of the electric light is?
Yes, just by the door.
I don't think there are more than two of them. There may be only one. I want to get well into the room. Then when I say go, I want you to switch on the lights. Do you understand?
Perfectly.
And don't scream or faint or anything. I won't let anyone hurt you.
My hero, murmured Virginia.
Bill peered at her suspiciously through the darkness. He heard a faint sound, which might have been either a sob or a laugh. Then he grasped the poker firmly and rose to his feet. He felt that he was fully alive to the situation. Very softly, he turned the handle of the door. It yielded and swung gently inwards. Bill felt Virginia close behind him. Together, they moved noiselessly into the room. At the farther end of the room, the torch was playing upon the Holbein picture. Silhouetted against it was the figure of a man, standing on a chair and gently tapping on the paneling. His back, of course, was to them, and he merely loomed up as a monstrous shadow. What more they might have seen cannot be told, for at that moment, Bill's nails squeaked upon the parquet floor. The man swung round, directing the powerful torch full upon them and almost dazzling them with the sudden glare. Bill did not hesitate. "Go!" he roared to Virginia and sprang for his man as she obediently pressed down the switch of the electric lights. The big chandelier should have been flooded with light, but instead, all that happened was the click of the switch. The room remained in darkness. Virginia heard Bill curse freely. The next minute, the air was filled with panting, scuffling sounds. The torch had fallen on the ground and extinguished itself in the fall. There was the sound of a desperate struggle going on in the darkness, but as to who was getting the better of it, and indeed, as to who was taking part in it, Virginia had no idea. Had there been anyone else in the room besides the man who was tapping the paneling? There might have been. Their glimpse had been only a momentary one. Virginia felt paralyzed. She hardly knew what to do. She dared not try to join in the struggle. To do so might hamper and not aid Bill. Her one idea was to stay in the doorway so that anyone trying to escape should not leave the room that way. At the same time, she disobeyed Bill's express instructions and screamed loudly and repeatedly for help. She heard the doors opening upstairs and a sudden gleam of light from the hall and the big staircase. If only Bill could hold his man until help came. But at that minute, there was a final terrific upheaval. They must have crashed into one of the figures in armor, for it fell to the ground with a deafening noise. Virginia saw dimly a figure springing for the window, and at the same time heard Bill cursing and disengaging himself from fragments of armor. For the first time she left her post and rushed wildly for the figure at the window. But the window was already unlatched. The intruder had no need to stop and fumble for it. He sprang out and raced away down the terrace and round the corner of the house. Virginia raced after him. She was young and athletic, and she turned the corner of the terrace not many seconds after her quarry. But there she ran headlong into the arms of a man who was emerging from a small side door. It was Hiram P. Fish.
"Gee, it's a lady," he exclaimed.
"Why, I beg your pardon, Mrs. Revel. I took you for one of the thugs fleeing from justice."
"He's just past this way," cried Virginia breathlessly. "Can't we catch him?"
But even as she spoke, she knew it was too late. The man must have gained the park by now, and it was a dark night with no moon. She retraced her steps to the council chamber, Mr. Fish by her side, discoursing in a soothing monotone upon the habits of burglars in general, of which he seemed to have a wide experience. Lord Cadham, Bundle, and various frightened servants were standing in the doorway of the council chamber.
"What the devil's the matter?" asked Bundle. "Is it burglars? What are you and Mr. Fish doing, Virginia?"
Taking a midnight stroll?
Virginia explained the events of the evening.
How frightfully exciting, commented Bundle. You don't usually get a murder and a burglary crowded into one weekend. What's the matter with the lights in here? They're all right everywhere else.
That mystery was soon explained. The bulbs had simply been removed and laid in a row against the wall. Mounted on a pair of steps, the dignified Treadwell, dignified even in undress, restored illumination to the stricken apartment.
If I'm not mistaken, said Lord Cadaham, in his sad voice as he looked around him, this room has recently been the center of somewhat violent activity.
There was some justice in the remark. Everything that could have been knocked over had been knocked over. The floor was littered with splintered chairs, broken china, and fragments of armor.
How many of them were there? Asked Bundle. It seems to have been a desperate fight.
Only one, I think, said Virginia.
But even as she spoke, she hesitated a little. Certainly only one person, a man, had passed out through the window. But as she had rushed after him, she had a vague impression of a rustle somewhere close at hand. If so, the second occupant of the room could have escaped through the door. Perhaps, though, the rustle had been an effect of her own imagination.
Bill appeared suddenly at the window. He was out of breath and panting hard.
"Damn the fellow!" he exclaimed wrathfully. "He's escaped. I've been hunting all over the place. Not a sign of him."
"Cheer up, Bill," said Virginia. "Better luck next time."
"Well," said Lord Cadaham, "what do you think we'd better do now? Go back to bed? I can't get hold of Badgeworthy at this time of night. Treadwell, you know the sort of thing that's necessary. Just see to it, will you?"
"Very good, my lord."
With a sigh of relief, Lord Cadaham prepared to retreat.
"That beggar Isaacstein sleeps soundly," he remarked, with a touch of envy. "You'd have thought all this row would have brought him down."
He looked across at Mr. Fish. "You found time to dress, I see," he added.
"I flung on a few articles of clothing, yes," admitted the American.
"Very sensible of you," said Lord Cadaham.
"Damn chilly things, pajamas."
He yawned. In a rather depressed mood, the house party retired to bed.
Chapter 18. Second Midnight Adventure.
The first person that Anthony saw as he alighted from his train on the following afternoon was Superintendent Battle. His face broke into a smile.
"I've returned according to contract," he remarked.
"Did you come down here to assure yourself of the fact?"
Battle shook his head.
"I wasn't worrying about that, Mr. Cade. I happened to be going to London, that's all."
"You have such a trustful nature, Battle."
"Do you think so, sir?"
"No, I think you're deep, very deep. Still waters, you know, and all that sort of thing. So, you're going to London?"
"I am, Mr. Cade."
"I wonder why?"
The detective did not reply.
"You're so chatty," remarked Anthony. "That's what I like about you."
A far-off twinkle showed in Battle's eyes.
"What about your own little job, Mr. Cade?" he inquired. "How did that go off?"
"I've drawn blank, Battle. For the second time, I've been proved hopelessly wrong. Galling, isn't it?"
"What was the idea, sir, if I may ask?"
"I suspected the French governess, Battle. A, upon the grounds of her being the most unlikely person, according to the canons of the best fiction. B, because there was a light in her room on the night of the tragedy."
"That wasn't much to go upon."
"You're quite right. It was not. But I discovered that she had only been here a short time, and I also found a suspicious Frenchman spying around the place. You know all about him, I suppose."
"You mean the man who calls himself Monsieur Chel, staying at the Cricketers? A traveler in silk?"
"That's it, is it? What about him? What does Scotland Yard think?"
"His actions have been suspicious," said Superintendent Battle expressionlessly.
"Very suspicious, I should say. Well, I put two and two together. French governess in the house, French stranger outside. I decided that they were in league together, and I hurried off to interview the lady with whom Mademoiselle Brun had lived for the last 10 years. I was fully prepared to find that she had never heard of any such person as Mademoiselle Brun. But I was wrong, Battle. Mademoiselle is the genuine article." Battle nodded.
"I must admit," said Anthony, "that as soon as I spoke to her, I had an uneasy conviction that I was barking up the wrong tree. She seemed so absolutely the governess." Again, Battle nodded.
"All the same, Mr. Cade, you can't always go by that. Women especially can do a lot with makeup. I've seen quite a pretty girl with the color of her hair altered, a sallow complexion stain, slightly reddened eyelids, and most efficacious of all, dowdy clothes, who would fail to be identified by 9 people out of 10 who had seen her in her former character. Men haven't got quite the same pull. You can do something with the eyebrows, and of course, different sets of false teeth alter the whole expression. But there are always the ears. There's an extraordinary lot of character in ears, Mr. Cade."
"Don't look so hard at mine, Battle," complained Anthony. "You make me quite nervous."
"I'm not talking of false beards and grease paint," continued the superintendent. "That's only for books. No, there are very few men who can escape identification and put it over on you. In fact, there's only one man I know who has a positive genius for impersonation. King Victor. Ever heard of King Victor, Mr. Cade?" There was something so sharp and sudden about the way the detective put the question that Anthony checked the words that were rising to his lips.
"King Victor," he said reflectively instead. "Somehow, I seem to have heard the name. One of the most celebrated jewel thieves in the world. Irish father, French mother, can speak 5 languages at least. He's been serving a sentence, but his time was up a few months ago."
"Really? And where is he supposed to be now?"
"Well, Mr. Cade, that's what we'd rather like to know."
"The plot thickens," said Anthony lightly. "No chance of his turning up here, is there? But I suppose he wouldn't be interested in political memoirs, only in jewels."
"There is no saying," said Superintendent Battle. "For all we know, he may be here already."
"Disguised as the second footman? Splendid.
You'll recognize him by his ears, and cover yourself with glory."
"Quite fond of your little joke, aren't you, Mr. Cade? By the way, what do you think of that curious business at Staines?"
"Staines?" said Anthony. "What's been happening at Staines?"
"It was in Saturday's papers. I thought you might have seen about it. Man found by the roadside, shot. A foreigner. It was in the papers again today, of course."
"I did see something about it," said Anthony carelessly. "Not suicide, apparently."
"No, there was no weapon. As yet, the man hasn't been identified."
"You seem very interested," said Anthony, smiling. "No connection with Prince Michael's death, is there?"
His hand was quite steady. So were his eyes. Was it his fancy that Superintendent Battle was looking at him with peculiar intentness?
"Seems to be quite an epidemic of that sort of thing," said Battle. "But, well, I dare say there's nothing in it." He turned away, beckoning to a porter as the London train came thundering in. Anthony drew a faint sigh of relief. He strolled across the park in an unusually thoughtful mood. He purposely chose to approach the house from the same direction as that from which he had come on the fateful Thursday night, and as he drew near to it, he looked up at the windows, cudgeling his brains, to make sure of the one where he had seen the light. Was he quite sure that it was the second from the end? And doing so, he made a discovery. There was an angle at the corner of the house, in which was a window set farther back. standing on one spot, you counted this window as the first, and the first one built over the council chamber as the second. But move a few yards to the right, and part built out over the council chamber appeared to be the end of the house. The first window was invisible, and the two windows of the rooms over the council chamber would have appeared the first and second from the end. Where exactly had he been standing when he'd seen the light flash up? Anthony found the question very hard to determine. A matter of a yard or so made all the difference, but one point was made abundantly clear. It was quite possible that he had been mistaken in describing the light as occurring in the second room from the end. It might equally well have been the third. Now, who occupied the third room? Anthony was determined to find out as soon as possible. Fortune favored him. In the hall, Treadwell had just set the massive silver urn in its place on the tea tray. Nobody else was there. "Hello, Treadwell," said Anthony. "I wanted to ask you something. Who has the third room from the end on the west side? Over the council chamber, I mean." Treadwell reflected for a minute or two. "That would be the American gentleman's room, sir. Mr. Fish." "Oh, it is. Thank you." "Not at all, sir." Treadwell prepared to depart, then paused. The desire to be the first to impart news makes even pontifical butlers human. "Perhaps you've heard, sir, of what occurred last night." "Not a word," said Anthony. "What did occur last night?" "An attempt at robbery, sir." "Not really. Was anything taken?" "No, sir. The thieves were dismantling the suits of armor in the council chamber when they were surprised and forced to flee. Unfortunately, they got clear away." "That's very extraordinary," said Anthony. "The council chamber again. Did they break in that way?" "It is supposed, sir, that they forced the window." Satisfied with the interest his information had aroused, Treadwell resumed his retreat, but brought up with a dignified apology. "I beg your pardon, sir. I didn't hear you come in, and didn't know you were standing just behind me." Mr. Isaacstein, who'd been the victim of the impact, waved his hand in a friendly fashion. "No harm done, my good fellow. I assure you, no harm done." Treadwell retired looking contemptuous, and Isaacstein came forward and dropped into an easy chair. "Hello, Cade, so you're back again. Been hearing all about last night's little show?" "Yes," said Anthony. "Rather an exciting weekend, isn't it?" "I should imagine that last night was the work of local men," said Isaacstein. "It seems a clumsy, amateurish affair." "Is there anyone about here who collects armor?" asked Anthony. "It seems a curious thing to select." "Very curious," agreed Isaacstein. He paused a minute, and then said slowly, "The whole position here is very unfortunate." There was something almost menacing in his tone. "I don't quite understand," said Anthony. "Why are we all being kept here in this way? The inquest was over yesterday. The prince's body will be moved to London, where it's being given out that he died of heart failure. And still, nobody's allowed to leave the house. Mr. Lomax knows no more than I do. He refers me to Superintendent Battle." "Superintendent Battle has something up his sleeve," said Anthony thoughtfully. "And it seems the essence of his plan that nobody should leave. But excuse me, Mr. Cade. You've been away." "With a string tied to my leg. I've no doubt that I was shadowed the whole time. I shouldn't have been given a chance of disposing of the revolver or anything of that kind." "Ah, the revolver," said Isaacstein thoughtfully. "That has not been found, I think." "Not yet. Possibly thrown into the lake in passing." "Very possibly." "Where's Superintendent Battle? I've not seen him this afternoon." "He's gone to London. I met him at the station."
"Gone to London? Really? Did he say when he'd be back?"
"Early tomorrow, so I understand." Virginia came in with Lord Cadaham and Mr. Fish. She smiled a welcome at Anthony.
"So you're back, Mr. Cade.
Have you heard all about our adventures last night?
Why, truly, Mr. Cade, said Hiram Fish, it was a night of strenuous excitement. Did you hear that I mistook Mrs. Revel for one of the thugs?
And in the meantime, said Anthony,
the thug
got clear away, said Mr. Fish mournfully.
Do pour out, said Lord Cadaham to Virginia. I don't know where Bundle is.
Virginia officiated. Then she came and sat down near Anthony.
Come to the boathouse after tea, she said in a low voice. Bill and I have got a lot to tell you.
Then she joined lightly in the general conversation. The meeting at the boathouse was duly held. Virginia and Bill were bubbling over with their news. They agreed that a boat in the middle of the lake was the only safe place for confidential conversation. Having paddled out a significant distance, the full story of last night's adventure was related to Anthony. Bill looked a little sulky. He wished Virginia would not insist on bringing this colonial fellow into it.
"It's very odd," said Anthony when the story was finished. "What do you make of it?" he asked Virginia.
"I think they were looking for something," she returned promptly. "The burglar idea is absurd. They thought the something, whatever it was, might be concealed in the suits of armor. That's clear enough, but why tap the paneling? That looks more as though they were looking for a secret staircase or something of that kind."
"There's a priest's hole at Chimneys, I know," said Virginia, "and I believe there's a secret staircase as well. Lord Cadaham would tell us all about it. What I want to know is, what can they have been looking for?"
"It can't be the memoirs," said Anthony. "They're a great bulky package. It must have been something small."
"George knows, I expect," said Virginia. "I wonder whether I can get it out of him. All along, I felt there was something behind all this."
"You say there was only one man," pursued Anthony, "but that there might possibly be another, as you thought you heard someone going towards the door as you sprang out of the window."
"The sound was very slight," said Virginia. "It might have just been my imagination."
"That's quite possible. But in case it wasn't your imagination, the second person must have been an inmate of the house. I wonder now..."
"What are you wondering at?" asked Virginia.
"The thoroughness of Mr. Hiram Fish, who dresses himself completely when he hears screams for help downstairs."
"There's something in that," agreed Virginia. "And then there's Isaac Stein, who sleeps through it all. That's suspicious, too. Surely he couldn't."
"There's that fellow Boris," suggested Bill. "He looks an unmitigated ruffian. Michael's servant, I mean."
"Chimneys is full of suspicious characters," said Virginia. "I dare say the others are just as suspicious of us. I wish Superintendent Battle hadn't gone to London. I think it's rather stupid of him. By the way, Mr. Cade, I've seen that peculiar-looking Frenchman about once or twice, spying round the park."
"It's a mix-up," confessed Anthony. "I've been away on a wild goose chase. Made a thorough ass of myself. Look here. To me, the whole question seems to resolve itself into this. Did the men find what they were looking for last night?"
"Supposing they didn't," said Virginia. "I'm pretty sure they didn't, as a matter of fact."
"Just this. I believe they'll come again. They know, or they soon will know, that Battle's in London. They'll take the risk and come again tonight."
"Do you really think so?"
"It's a chance. Now we three will form a little syndicate. Eversley and I will conceal ourselves with due precautions in the council chamber."
"What about me?" interrupted Virginia. "Don't think you're going to leave me out of it."
"Listen to me, Virginia," said Bill. "This is men's work."
"Don't be an idiot, Bill. I'm in on this. Don't you make any mistake about it. The syndicate will keep watch tonight."
It was settled thus, and the details of the plan were laid. After the party had retired to bed, first one and then another of the syndicate crept down. They were all armed with powerful electric torches, and in the pocket of Anthony's coat lay a revolver.
Anthony had said that he believed another attempt to resume the search would be made. Nevertheless, he did not expect that the attempt would be made from outside. He believed that Virginia had been correct in her guess that someone had passed her in the dark the night before, and as he stood in the shadow of an old oak dresser, it was towards the door, and not the window, that his eyes were directed. Virginia was crouching behind a figure in armor on the opposite wall, and Bill was by the window. The minutes passed at interminable length. 1 o'clock chimed, then the half hour, then 2, then half hour. Anthony felt stiff and cramped. He was coming slowly to the conclusion that he had been wrong. No attempt would be made tonight. And then he stiffened suddenly, all his senses on alert. He had heard a footstep on the terrace outside. Silence again, and then a low, scratching noise at the window. Suddenly it ceased, and the window swung open. A man stepped across the sill into the room. He stood quite still for a moment, peering round as though listening. After a minute or two, seemingly satisfied, he switched on a torch he carried and turned it rapidly round the room. Apparently, he saw nothing unusual. The three watchers held their breath. He went over to the same bit of paneled wall he'd been examining the night before. And then, a terrible knowledge smote Bill. He was going to sneeze. The wild race through the dew-laden park the night before had given him a chill. All day he had sneezed intermittently. A sneeze was due now, and nothing on earth would stop it. He adopted all the remedies he could think of. He pressed his upper lip, swallowed hard, threw back his head and looked at the ceiling. As a last resort, he held his nose and pinched it violently. It was of no avail. He sneezed. A stifled, checked, emasculated sneeze, but a startling sound in the deadly quiet of the room. The stranger sprang round, and in the same minute, Anthony acted. He flashed on his torch and jumped full for the stranger. In another minute, they were down on the floor together. "Lights!" shouted Anthony. Virginia was ready at the switch. The lights came on, true and full tonight. Anthony was on top of his man. Bill leant down to give him a hand. "And now," said Anthony, "let's see who you are, my fine fellow." He rolled his victim over. It was the neat, dark-bearded stranger from the Cricketers. "Very nice indeed," said an approving voice. They all looked up startled. The bulky form of Superintendent Battle was standing in the open doorway. "I thought you were in London, Superintendent Battle," said Anthony. Battle's eyes twinkled. "Did you, sir?" he said. "Well, I thought it would be a good thing if I was thought to be going." "And it has been," agreed Anthony, looking down at his prostrate foe. To his surprise, there was a slight smile on the stranger's face. "May I get up, gentlemen?" he inquired. "You are 3-1. Anthony kindly hauled him onto his legs. The stranger settled his coat, pulled up his collar, and directed a keen look at Battle. "I demand pardon," he said, "but I do understand that you're a representative from Scotland Yard." "That's right," said Battle. "Then I will present to you my credentials." He smiled rather ruefully. "I would have been wise to do so before." He took some papers from his pocket and handed them to the Scotland Yard detective. At the same time, he turned back the lapel of his coat and showed something pinned there. Battle gave an exclamation of astonishment. He looked through the papers and handed them back with a little bow. "I'm sorry you've been manhandled, monsieur," he said, "but you brought it upon yourself, you know." He smiled, noting the astonished expression on the faces of the others. "This is a colleague we've been expecting for some time," he said. "Monsieur Lemoine, of the Sûreté in Paris."